The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Good morning, it's Donna Marie Doherty in for Greg this Friday, the 29th of May, just on the cusp of the bank holiday weekend. It'll be business as usual here on The Greg Hughes Show. We'll have the review of the week in the news and we'll have Shannon on later with Scroll Patrol, along with some other very interesting interviews that you won't want to miss. Make sure that you get your say. Give us a text on WhatsApp or the regular text or on 086 60 25,000, or you can give us a call on 074 91 25,000. Now, I have my panel here joining us. First of all, we have Seamus McDade, Managing Director of Football Special. Seamus, good morning.
Morning, Delmarie. How are you doing?
All good, all good. I think I'll be better once we get these 10 minutes over. We also have with us Niamh McGuinness, a Sinn Féin representative. Good morning, Niamh.
Hi, Delmarie. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much for joining us. And finally, we have Dennis McGee, Councillor Dennis McGee of the 100% Redress Party in the Glenties Municipal District. Dennis, how are you? Okay, we'll see there if we can get Dennis. Dennis, I think you might just be muted. We'll get started, sure, and we'll see if Dennis can join us shortly. The first topic that we are going to be addressing today has been the sports ministers, Patrick O'Donovan and Charlie McConnellogue, confirmed that they're not going to be attending the upcoming Nations League matches against Israel as an act of a personal protest. What we're wondering is the government trying to have it both ways by staying at home while letting the FAA take the heat, or is a full sporting boycott the only principled stance left? Seamus McDade, I'll come to you first. What are your thoughts on it? Do you think are the ministers here, are they doing the right thing?
I think the ministers, I mean, fundamentally this is an FAI problem, so I can see why the ministers are stepping away. But I do feel like the FAI are in such a quandary here. And we've seen some very small protests that were at the game last night that will escalate even further. So I actually am more of the belief now after seeing last night than ever that I don't actually think this game will take place. I think that the FAI will be forced to either play the game behind closed doors or cancel or not fulfill the fixture at all. Because the level of opposition to this game is so large now, I can't see how they can continue to just plan, you know, as normal.
So I suppose that the thought is here, you know, will the FAI take action? Because if they don't, it's going to be the players in a very difficult position here.
Well, I actually thought watching the RT coverage last night that Richie Sadler, one of the panelists, just really summed it up by saying that, are we really going to tolerate a situation where 4 months from now, the Israeli flag is going to fly above the Aviva Stadium, their anthem is going to ring out around the stadium, potentially Catherine Connolly, after all that her family have suffered, is going to have to shake hands with all the players. Are we going to really treat this game like it is another normal international game? I don't think we should. I mean, fundamentally, the FAI are in a quandary here because they have mismanaged their affairs so badly that they can't really financially afford to fall out with UEFA, and you're right, it's going to fall on the players. Now, if the players, that's very difficult, but if they force the hands of the FAI, they'll be really stuck, I think. So in the last 24 hours, 24 hours ago, I would have thought, no, this game will go ahead. Now I'm much less sure.
Councillor Dennis McGee, good morning. What is your thoughts on this? You know, Ministers Patrick O'Donovan and Charlie McConnellogue, have they made the right move in saying, you know what, we're not going, we don't think it's right? Oh, I can't hear you there, Dennis. I think you may be, let's see if I can get you here. Try again there, see if this, you seem just to be muted there.
Yeah.
Oh, here we go.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can.
Yeah, good morning. On the face of it, they have, you know, but, you know, you have to go back to the very start, like, you know, and just where do you draw the line here? Like, you know, we should never be in this situation. The players should never be in this situation. UEFA have kind of messed up here big time because UEFA have allowed Israel, you know, I think they have six teams playing in the occupied territories within the West Bank, like. So when UEFA allow a team like Israel to play like that there, you know, it sets then, it takes it out of everybody else's hands. Like, you know, so the UEFA should have stepped in long, long time ago, because it's not fair. At the end of the day, you know, the Irish people have a lot of sympathy, solidarity, and history with the Palestinian people. You know, we see it every day on our screens. Like, and this goes back to, this didn't start in the 7th of October. This goes back to, you know, the 30s, 40s, you know, when Palestinian people were treated like second-class citizens. Like, so we can't have a situation where you normalise it. You know, we can't allow a state like Israel to become normal.
And see, just in the actions of the ministers, though. So the ministers now say that they're not going, and it is a symbolic gesture. Many people will agree with it, but others might say, you know, if governments appear too morally engaged without taking, you know, what would be seen to be maybe proper action, you know, is it a dangerous precedent?
No, but I mean, like, listen, the ministers and listen, fair play to them, you know, but they're coming from a weak point, like, you know, this should be a united force. Like, it should be absolutely no or absolutely it's going ahead. You know, where you have a couple of ministers coming out and saying, like, we're not going, we don't think it's morally right. So what makes it morally right for the government? Like, what value do you put on a child's life? You know, how many, like, does it take 200,000 people to be dead or killed or slaughtered or starved or displaced? Or, you know, what metrics do you use here, like, you know, to normalise a state like Israel? So for me, like, you know, I personally don't think the game will go ahead. Like, you know, if it does, it'll be behind closed doors somewhere. Like, I don't like the fact of just handing Israel 6 points either.
Yeah, because that is the flip side of it. I might come to you here on this, Niamh. If it's a case that, say, the game does go ahead, that the FAI decide that it's going to go ahead and that they don't want to pull it, and it's down to the footballers then, and they say, you know what, we don't want to do it. You know, that's, I heard someone say, we'll essentially be gifting Israel the 6 points, which a lot of people won't want either.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're absolutely hit the nail on the head, and the ministers are looking to have it both ways. I don't think the government or any individual ministers can claim the moral high ground, saying that they won't attend while leaving the players and the FAI to carry the consequences. I think we're seeing now that players are carrying that political and moral burden. Mm. And at the end of the day, they're footballers. They're not diplomats. And you can't be expecting athletes to shoulder the responsibility of foreign policy. These players, we can all empathise with them in the sense that they have careers and ambitions and contractual obligations. And the FAI, you know, they're operating under financial and international pressures. And I think it's unfair to expect footballers or sporting bodies to make what is ultimately a political decision by themselves. I think the responsibility lies solely with the government. And if Ireland believes, and I think that we all do, in a principled stance, then it's a necessary response, considering what's happening in Gaza and the wider region, that the government take the lead on this. Their position is clear, and I think they're just trying to shoulder the heat that they may face.
And then, so let's just take a hypothetical situation where this match is going ahead. You know, should the ministers leave the footballers to bear this by themselves? Should they go as an act of solidarity?
No, but I think that they should. I would just reaffirm that I don't think this match should be happening at all. I think we should be using, as an island, but primarily as a government, be using every peaceful and political lever available to us to put pressure on the Israeli government. And I think that would lead by the government taking control, calling off this match.
Seamus, if I just come back to you, there is, nobody will want to talk about it, but there is going to be financial repercussions here if the match doesn't go ahead. You know, what would that, I suppose, look like, you know, coming from a business background yourself?
Oh, it would be very substantial repercussions. Like, I think the Ireland is scheduled to host at least three or four games in the 2028 European Championships, I'd say there's a very strong chance if this game doesn't go ahead, we'll lose them games. There's obviously the financial ramifications of not having losing another home game. The FAI have season ticket holders that they'll have to reimburse. Although I think both people, you know, Councillor McGee has definitely said this game at best will go behind closed doors, so they probably won't be able to sell tickets to this game anyway. And then whatever other fines, it won't just be giving up 6 points. It'll be a lot more than that. And the FAI have allowed their own finances to become so bad that they actually can't afford to take a principled stance. Now, does, to Niamh's point, does the government now need to take ownership and say, well, we'll actually backstop that by, because we'll come in and pay whatever fine UEFA try and fine you, and show some leadership? That is what will need to happen from a financial perspective. It's whether they do that or not, I'm not sure. But there will be huge financial ramifications to this.
Councillor McGee, if the government were to do that, you know, the government is there to represent everybody in Ireland, and this mightn't be something that necessarily everybody in Ireland cares about, to be totally honest. You know, should they pay that fine if it comes to that?
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, you know, I can't understand why, like, there's different rules for different countries. Like, you know, the government and UEFA and FAI and the rest of them had no issue of banning Russia. Mm. So is it like Russia good bomb Israel, or Russia bad bomb Israel good bomb? You know, there should be no interaction with any government at all or any state that inflicts so much on a people. You know what I mean? Like what the Palestinians are going through. Whether the government should pay for the fines and all the rest. Yeah, well, I mean, that's up to the government, you know? Like, I just think that, you know, going back again, like, what value do you put on a life? Do you know what I mean? Mm. If, like, money shouldn't even be coming into this here, like, you know, everything seems to be about money. And the bigger picture, if we go against Israel, are we really going against Israel? Or in the background, is it Trump that's running the show here? Like, that's the problem. Like, are we afraid of annoying Israel? And then at the end of the day, Trump will come in and threaten us. I don't believe that that will happen. I think that from the get-go, it was done wrong. It should have been a complete no. Absolutely zero engagement, like enact the Occupies Territories Bill. Just stay away from rogue states.
We have a comment in here, Dennis. I say that you'll find interest in it, saying, so Minister McConnell is boycotting the game but voted against imposing sanctions on Israel. Talk about hypocrisy. Maybe he can use his spare time to sort out the defective concrete block crisis. Niamh, I'll just come to you finally before we take a break here. A lot of people are also questioning the fact that, you know, we didn't participate in Eurovision, and there was, you know, people talked again, and I know it ends up coming back to money, that there probably was a financial loss there. Why do you think there a difference is being made between Eurovision and football?
I don't know. Maybe you could argue that maybe sports and football at large have a larger base. I know myself, I was saddened to see Ireland sit out of Eurovision, not because I don't agree with their stance, but just, you know, it's a fun occasion, and maybe because there's a larger support base for football, maybe those that'll be disappointed by the actions. But as the two gentlemen have said, you know, we've seen principled stances from governments and societies in the past in regards to sports. And I think there's that famous phrase during apartheid South Africa, I might get it wrong here, no normal sporting in an abnormal society. And that's absolutely fair. Mm. You can't give legitimacy to a state that's acting immorally. And we, as an entire country, should have that moral consistency. It applied to Eurovision, and I think it should apply to tonight.
Okay, we'll just take some comments here before we go to an ad break. The reality in the Middle East is very different. I've lived there, and believe me, Hamas are brutal and Israel are right to retaliate in the way that they are. And we have another one here. It says, what about Hamas' anti-gay policy and throwing homosexuals off of tall buildings? Free Palestine, my behind. So that's the thoughts of listeners there. If you want to message in, it's 0860 25,000, or you give us a call on 074 91 25,000. Just another comment. Hi, Donna Marie, regarding the football. Our footballers are representing the country, which is a political entity. The politicians should ban Israelis from entering the country. The government should reimburse the FAI for financial losses. Ban the matches. So we'll go on here now to our next topic of discussion, which is about pedestrian safety and how much pedestrians should shoulder that responsibility. So Clare County Council's passed a motion on calling the Minister for Transport to make high-vis clothing legally mandatory for walkers and cyclists. Some councillors are comparing it to wearing a seatbelt. There's criticisms of it, though, saying that if we do that, we could be end up, you know, blaming pedestrians for collisions. And where that responsibility will lie then in terms of insurance, and if it comes down to suppose, courts and the likes of that. Niamh, I'll come back to you. Just what's your thoughts on this matter?
I mean, I do think it is common sense to encourage pedestrians and cyclists to be safe, encourage the use of high-vis clothing in many situations. You know, we're all aware that Donegal, being such a rural county, we've got very many areas of poor lighting and poor infrastructure, and I think that comes back then to, well, what is the need for high-vis clothing? Why are our pedestrians and cyclists at risk? And I think I would be a bit wary about making it maybe a legal requirement, if that then in turn would end up shifting the responsibility away from dangerous driving, away from speeding, and as I said, poor infrastructure. I would hate to see there be a change of culture in regards to that responsibility. So if it ends up that if someone is hit, maybe in a dangerous rural road with no footpath or no lighting, would the first question then turn to be, well, why are they wearing high-vis?
I think as well, an interesting point there on if it is legally required, are Gardaí going to be able to realistically enforce that if they're out and they see somebody walking without a high-vis?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. What would the penalties be? What would the work be like to keep this enforced and updated? You know, at what time do you mandate that it becomes necessary? Mm. It would be quite difficult.
Councillor Dennis McGee, you've been in very, very many council meetings where road safety is the topic of conversation. You know, I suppose high-vis will definitely help. Should it have to be enforced?
Like Niamh has said, like, you know, it's common sense to wear, in the current situation, to wear high-vis and make sure that you're seen when you're out walking or whatever. However, you know, I would definitely be cautious of making it like a legal requirement, because as was said before, you know, then you put the onus then on the pedestrian and you take away from the driver. And you have to remember, the driver is driving like a lethal weapon here, like, you know, like, and the driver has to have you know, regard for road safety, speed signs, knowing the environment, this, that and the other thing, like. But the fundamental thing is that we don't have the infrastructure, and that's the bottom line. Most of the rural roads, like, you know, you have to be nearly out in the middle of the road, you know. But you cannot get from A to B, like, until we get to a situation where we have safe places of walking for our people, our elderly, our school kids, all that kind of stuff. We're going to have to, you know, just make sure that you educate people on road safety and stuff, like, you know. But the fundamental thing is footpaths and lighting and, you know.
Well, we hear regularly in council meetings, you know, the officials are saying that between the different schemes, the funding's just not there. So would making high-vis a legal requirement, would that be something that could be implemented much quicker than trying to get footpaths built in every rural road in Ireland? Because that's a long way off.
Yeah, but I go back to the fact that, like, you know, you put the, you take the onus off then the driver and you put it on to a pedestrian that through no fault of their own, walking, trying to get from A to B with no means of doing that other than walking on the side of the road. Like, what, like, if you take, like, no funding, but yet we have funding for an active travel plan in Letterkenny, you know, that has been a complete disaster, like, and let's not call it anything else. That money would be, I think, better spent in rural areas. You know, we cannot discriminate against a person living in a rural area and somebody trying to get from A to B, where in most towns there's plenty of footpaths and safe places of walking, like, you know. So that money, I think, could have been well spent in rural areas. Like, that's my opinion.
Seamus, to come to you, Councillor McGee made a point about having proper education in place. Do you think that the education that's in place at the moment goes far enough, or are you still seeing people making very silly mistakes on the roads? I suppose just first in relation to pedestrians.
I don't think, I mean, there is a fairly good communications campaign around making sure you wear a high vis. And, you know, when you're out walking. And, I mean, I was part there of a very successful cycle that we done for Milford GA Club. And I would say of the 150 cyclists that set off that day, I would say nearly all had high vises on them or some sort of reflective clothing. Mm. So, I, you know, it's a bit of a dereliction of duty from Clare County Council to say, you all should get high vises as opposed to funding street lighting and footpaths. Like, you know, like, as a council's job is to go and make the infrastructure there that's safe for pedestrians and cyclists to be around. Mm. Not just to, like, come out with things like this. This is what the RSA should be lobbying for, which they do. There is loads of campaigns out there that say wear high vises. And as I say, the uptake is pretty good. The uptake of footpaths is pretty poor. And that's on Clare County Council, that's, and the various county councils.
I don't know what the footpath ratio in Clare's like, well, but I'm just guess, even thinking to hear.
It's not amazing. Like, it's, you know, like, we know, yeah, it's not amazing.
So just actually, I'm just interested to know, out of the cyclists, were they high vises that they brought themselves? Were they provided as part of the cycle, or how did that work?
They were high vises they brought themselves. And I would say 100% had some reflective clothing on. So it's the uptake on that is people, and you just wouldn't really do, again, when we were training for that cycle, you really wouldn't go out without a high vis. Mm. So I would feel that people are very well versed in that. And yes, road users need to be more responsible for sure. But if there is a stretch of road that's dangerous, there is an obligation on councils and the roads authority to make that stretch of road safer and not just keep putting it back on the road users, be it cars or pedestrians or bikes.
Yeah, there's, I suppose there'll be people who may think that having an emotion like this will be a good headline, or it'll be a good, it will be good for the optics maybe, rather than the point that you're making, addressing the proper issue at hand. There, we have a comment in here saying, if you want walking safety, do something about the amount of vehicles parking on footpaths. And that actually is quite an issue. Actually, I'm just thinking of where I live. There was, I myself had a near miss yesterday where there was cars parked on the footpaths on either side going around a bend. So I was in the middle of the road, but there was a car coming on the middle of the road the opposite way. And I suppose if that was a cyclist, you know, it's going to be a lot more of a frightening near miss.
Yeah, but again, I mean, I suppose you're not supposed to park on a footpath. Mm. So, like, there is an obligation then on the guards or somebody to move them vehicles along. And like you said at the very start of this, if they're not going to enforce that, when are they going to go out and enforce that people are not wearing high vises? You know, so in reality, that you can bring in all these rules you want, but if there isn't enough Gardaí or other enforcement agencies to go enforce these rules, then it's not going to make any difference anyway.
I will just, Niamh, to come just to you again. Is it a fair comparison to put it to a seatbelt?
Possibly, but I think it's a cleaner line and understanding that when you're in a car, you wear your seatbelt. That keeps you safe at all times. A high vis vest is never going to replicate the same value as a safe footpath or a safe cycle lane. Whereas your seatbelt is always going to protect you. And I think a proposal like this maybe distracts people from the fact that we have decades and decades of poor infrastructure and poor investment into our towns and rural communities.
Okay, then that seems to be the overarching view, that the infrastructure needs to be prioritised. I just have another comment on this one. It says people don't like change, and I'm sure when seatbelts were introduced as a law, there was pushback there as well. We'll take this next ad break here, and whenever we come back, we'll be discussing the should people be able to approach ministers, and that's off the back of the incident with the Burkes and Minister Hildegard Nocton in Donegal earlier. So if you want to have your say in that, you can get in touch with Caroline and Shannon now. Welcome back. This is the Greg Hughes Show. We're in the middle of our Friday panel. Earlier we were discussing Israel, and particularly the Israel versus Ireland match, and the sports minister saying that they're not going to attend as a personal act of protest. We have a comment in here, and it says, if Ireland were in the World Cup, they would have played the US, Russia or England, and other countries who even in the past who have or are committing genocide or illegal atrocities on other nations. Is it a complex issue? But the Irish government are hypocritical, as no government representatives are going to attend. They're going to block some Israeli goods while allowing services, and that's in relation to the Occupied Territories Bill. Maybe they should have taken a stand as having the powerful EU chairmanship in the upcoming EU and act as leaders rather than hypocrites. Well, that's an interesting take there. And if we have time, we might just come back to that comment and discuss it here with our panel. But now we're going to talk about where does the line sit in relation to protest and harassment. And it's off of the back of an incident that happened in Donegal earlier this week. So should government ministers be open to direct confrontation by protesters wherever they visit? Or did the Burke family's recent protest at the school gates in Milford completely cross the line by involving and potentially distressing young children? And just to make it clear, there's differing views on the children's exposure to the incident. Councillor Dennis McGee, I want to start with you with this here. I suppose your political party was built on protests at the start, you know, in the defective concrete blocks movement. Maybe just for now, we'll take the Burke situation out of it. Where would you draw the line, or what do you think should be acceptable?
Well, listen, we should never, ever take away the right to protest. That's fundamental. Every individual, every citizen in the country should have a right to protest. Government ministers should never be insulated, you know, to an extent where access can't be gained. You know, so I suppose the question is, you know, the line is between protesting and just pure intimidation. Like, that's where the line is. Like. So I suppose democracy works best when people, you know, can engage with government ministers, people that are doing making policies and stuff, like, you know. So it's trying to find that balance without being up at somebody's face and having a little bit of regard for your ministers or opposition TDs or councillors or whatever it may be, like, you know. So, you know, I don't know really like how bad it was down there. But, you know, the other side is without kind of creating a situation like and it's worked perfectly in this case. Like, you know, if they had been down and they were peaceful and everything, they wouldn't get any headlines, like, you know. So it's trying to find that balance of between like causing some kind of a disruption without kind of intimidating kids or children or whatever. I don't know the situation. I wasn't there. But I fundamentally would back the right to protest, and that no minister or no Taoiseach should be completely insulated from the regular person on the ground, you know, to get their point across.
Seamus, where do you think the line is between a peaceful protest and an unpeaceful protest?
Well, I think Councillor McGee made a really good point there. It's where it goes from protest to intimidation is really important. Like, but And I do think, I know, I think they brought in legislation you can't protest at the ministers' houses anymore, which I think is fair. Shouldn't be, you know, that's their own personal space. In this instance, the minister was at work, you know, as such. So she met a protester at her job. We have to allow the right to protest. So it is just when it crosses line to become intimidation is but who decides that line? Again, you're hoping that maybe the Gardaí would do
Yeah,
that.
And I suppose where this one came into difficulty was because it was at the school gate. We can see from the Burke's videos that they see, it appears anyway, that they may have went on to the school grounds. You know, but regardless of taking that bit out, you know, we saw then that, you know, they had a mic and a speaker and it was at the school gates. And, you know, that's not just the minister that's going to, you know, there was students inside taking exams. And we had a text from a mother who said that their son was distracted and disrupted during that.
But you sort of, it's not a protest if you're not disrupting somebody. Like, you know, to get your point across, you're going to have to disrupt people. That's sort of the part of the protest. And while I would be completely opposed to the opinions that are being protested about, it doesn't mean that I don't believe they have the right to protest. I remember when I was in college, we did protests where we blocked the Minister for Finance getting into UCD to speak at an event. So it would be completely hypocritical for me then to come on and say, you know, it's only okay to protest on things I agree with.
Yeah, and I feel like that's where people have been coming out on sort of both sides. I'll come here to you, where there's people who are saying that they do agree with what the Burkes are advocating for in relation to Enoch, and you know, that they're agreeing with the grounds that it's about transgenderism. Whereas, you know, if you really dig into it, that's not the particular issue and why he is in jail. But there's people who are saying they agree with that sentiment, but that they shouldn't have done this. Niamh, what do you take on that?
Well, I think that your first question in regards to their protest, I've seen the videos. I wasn't personally there. I didn't see it as a protest. I thought it was a confrontation, and an aggressive one at that. And just like Seamus has said, at university, I've taken a part in a fair few protests myself. We all understand what they look like, and you can disagree strongly with the government. I have many opinions of times, but we have a responsibility as adults not to distress or even potentially distress children. But also, I watch those videos, and as a maybe it's from a female understanding, I didn't like how they approached the minister.
In what way?
I thought it was very aggressive. And I've seen videos of the Burkes also, I think it was in Galway, so not in the same instance, but also in Galway, really up in the minister's face. And when you're encountering instances like this time and time again, there comes to a stage where you're saying, enough is enough. This isn't a protest anymore. And whilst you're free to speak your mind and your opinions, there is a time and a place for that, and only when it's appropriate. And it made me feel a bit uncomfortable. And so to then put that in front of school gates and in front of children, I don't think it was right.
I think to take the incident in Galway, and I know that they also had approached Micheál Martin before the Donegal incident happened. Say that Galway incident happened, it wasn't the Burkes, it was maybe parents advocating for their children, or it was road infrastructure or something along the lines of that. But the we'll call it passion, was still there, and the way that it was carried out was the same. Do you think would people have the same feeling about it?
I would like to think so. I think the manner in which they conducted themselves was entirely inappropriate. We all have a right to freedom of speech and protest, but it's the manner in which we conduct ourselves, and I don't think that was up to standard. I have my own personal issues with what the Burkes are campaigning against, but I also, very plainly and simply put, I don't agree with how they acted on that day. And I think, Dennis, you highlighted that, you know, you protest to disrupt and maybe to gain attention, and they feel passionate about their cause, and therefore they want the media attention, they want eyes on them, and this protest achieves that. But I don't think the Burkes are lacking in attention or access to the media. They're always welcome to conduct interviews. They've garnered a huge social media following, and so I think it's a diversion tactic from how they behaved in Milford. It was awful.
We're going to just look at a few comments here. So the Burkes were right to confront the minister. All ministers should be available to the public and less of playing the superiority card. They are paid huge salaries and they should get out and meet the people and less swanning around the EU looking busy. We'll discuss that point. We'll just take an ad break here and we'll come back to discuss the rest of this just after these messages. Look into the weather today then. Any lingering patchy rain and drizzle in the northwest will clear this morning to give way to a largely dry day with plenty of sunshine developing this afternoon, and that's with highest temperatures of 17 to 23 degrees. And just looking out the window here, it does look a bit duller definitely than the last few days anyway. So we'll see. We'll see. Hopefully the weather will stay nice for the bank holiday weekend. Now, before the break, I'd read a comment there saying that the Burkes were right to confront the minister and that the ministers, essentially, they're paid well enough to be dealing with this sort of thing. Councillor McGee, I'm going to come back to you first. And before you became a politician, you were a campaigner, and many would say that you still are a campaigner. Did you ever have to come up against this type of conversation of maybe being accused of being aggressive and needing to dial it back?
Well, Donna, you know that I'm a very quiet, mannerly kind of a person,
yes,
so I can't say that I would have come up against that there. But listen, see, the whole idea is, like, and we did go to plenty of protests, and the whole objective is to get media attention, you know, to shine a light on the subject matter at the time. You know, so that's the fundamental thing. But again, I go back to finding, you know, we would have been criticised. Yeah, there was I think it might have been called off in the end, like, you know, where there was a slow go protest, you know, arranged for Letterkenny and stuff, like, you know, and I don't think it went ahead after reflection and stuff, like, you know, but the main thing is that, like, you know, we cannot lose sight of the fact that we have to be able to protest. You know, we have to be able to do that. How you do that is the question. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't agree. I don't think I've ever ran. Well, I might have actually, but yeah, as somebody said before, it might have been hypocritical of me, kind of. So
yeah.
I'd be reluctant to say, like, you know,
but do
not
you
to protest,
think?
Like, you know, the whole idea is to get as much attention to your subject as you possibly can, you know, without interfering with people's. I don't agree with going to ministers' houses or getting their families involved or none of that, like, you know. But
do you think, is there a point where the likes of the Burkes now, and we've seen from discourse, well, from here on the show, where the lady had said, I agree with them, but I don't like what they did with my son sitting an exam, you know, where they could end up losing support?
Well, if anything, they seem to be gathering support, Donna. Like, you know, I mean, as you said yourself, like, they have a massive, I don't know if it was you that said it or not, like, but they have a massive following online, like, you know. Mm-hmm. And maybe at the end of the day, what they need to do is what we did, is go the democratic route, like, you know,
mm-hmm.
and just run for election or whatever and see then what kind of backing they have. Or is this just people sitting at their houses kind of putting in a comment, like, you know, so.
Yeah. Seamus, to come to you here, there's, you mentioned the point about that you had protested in college, that blocking a finance minister from entering a college is different from, say, being outside one of the minister's houses. Do you think are politicians too quick to cross that line of saying that this is harassment? You know, should they
I kind of do agree with Niamh. Like the video from the Scourers of Milford, it's pretty unedifying on them and their protest. You know, it doesn't look good. Like, it's not really furthering your agenda. It is protest sort of for protest's sake. So no, I think I actually do feel a level of sympathy in that. I'm sure the political discourse at the moment is very toxic, and it is difficult to be a politician, and probably especially with the rise of social media, you're so accessible now. But they should still be exposed to a level of protest so that they're aware or they're unhappy. What I would particularly highlight in this case is what the Burke seem to not also appreciate is we also are all entitled to an opinion on what they're doing.
Yes.
And they seem to have a big issue when people. So if Father Duffy wants to criticize their protest, that is also his right. And for them then to doorstep him and approach him and all, you know, and really get in his face is very indicative of them and their standing.
And that was, I kind of found it a bit striking that they had shared the video or the photo of Father Duffy. You know, to be a politician is to put yourself in the public domain and to be open to criticism. Some will say that it's the same if you become a priest or any, I suppose, figure of religion. But it just, it felt different, I think, maybe the best way to say
it. Yeah, I mean, it is different. He isn't an elected official, so it is different. His door is always open to people. And he is, again, he is perfectly entitled to and share an opinion, you know, as all we all are here. In the same way, and that's what the Burkes are sharing their opinion, which I'm advocating for them being allowed to do. So they then can't turn around and say, well, nobody else can have an opposite opinion. So, you know, it was reflective of them. And like Niamh said, how much more media attention could they really get? Like Dennis has made a very good point. If just run for office now, you know, if you think you want to change, if you think that Ireland is so far down the transgender ideology road, run for office and get the laws changed.
And there's parties there. There has been, people who ran for election that was a large part of their campaign, and most of them weren't voted in.
Right, which might tell you what the sentiment of the public at large is. And like, not, you know, so not a Facebook comment, an actual vote.
Niamh, just to come to you here now, the topic that the Burkes are, the whole issue of sexuality and transgenderism, and, you know, at what age is that valid? It's a very controversial, maybe. It's, you know, a lot of people are going to have a lot of feelings about it, but you're only really going to hear the people that shout the loudest, and I suppose that's what the Burkes are trying to achieve. In terms of this happening at school grounds, you know, should there be efforts made to protect schools in the way that the ministers' houses are protected?
You would think not. You would think that this wouldn't need to be discussed and that schools would be respected as they are, but maybe so. I find the actions of the Burkes perplexing, honestly. They have such a fear of what they call the transgender ideology, and they wish to protect our kids from that. And, you know, maybe they feel so strongly for that, but then why stand outside a school with a loudspeaker and force the hard conversations onto the kids and have them hear that in a toxic, aggressive manner with the minister who had called in for a visit. If you're wishing to protect them from it, and I think that they don't wish for these conversations to be had at all in school, so why stand outside with a loudspeaker?
That's an interesting point, actually. If you're trying to shield children from this, why do it outside of school? And I remember speaking with a few of the people who were there afterwards, and they all kind of started the conversation in the same way, as in there was photos being taken, and then there was a lot of shouting, and everybody thought that something had happened. Was there a medical emergency? Had somebody collapsed? So it was frightening to be in so much noise and be like, what is it that's happening? You know, so a lot of people say that is intimidation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing that we're really lucky to have here in Ireland is our accessibility to our ministers, our TDs and our councillors. They're in the constituency I think 2 days a week. That's fantastic. You know, we have TDs and counsellors that attend local funerals, and that accessibility to them and that relationship that we've been able to foster, we should keep going. And you would hate for confrontational behaviour to disrupt that or risk that in any kind of way.
There's an interesting comment here saying the government approached the peaceful fuel protests to label them as a blockade and mentioned the army getting involved, but yet everybody is saying that the Birks protest was aggressive. What do you think?
Said that when they mentioned the army getting involved, that was nonsense. So whoever texted that in, must they have selective memory loss? Because every single person rang up your radio station to say it was outrageous whenever the minister said the army were getting involved.
Do you think is it a fair comparison to put that to people saying that what the Birks did was aggressive?
Well, it's a protest. So no, both protests were equally warranted and equally because they were protests. When it becomes aggressive is the question, and I'm not going to be the judge and jury of when it becomes aggressive. But there are laws there that should
protect that. We're actually just looking here. We're sort of coming up short on time here, so I just want to thank Seamus McDade, Managing Director of Football Special, Councillor Dennis McGee, 100% Redress Councillor of the Glen Tisch Municipal District, and Niamh McGuinness, Sinn Féin Representative. Thank you all very much for joining me this morning on the News Review. Welcome back to the Greg Hughes Show. It's Donna Marie Doherty in this morning. And I just want to get to some of your comments here. They're mostly about the Birks, just off the back of the news panel there. So the school is public property and it belongs to the taxpayers. Therefore, the Birks were 100% right to protest, plus there was no children present at the time. Now, there was no children outside, but I do believe that they were inside the school. The government and the church are the ones breaking the law. Another comment, there's been at least 3 similar cases to Enoch Birks in the UK and the US. The sacked teachers' rights were upheld and they were reinstated at their jobs. Enoch Birks' case was dealt with wrongly from the very start. The original principal was out of the picture when the courts took over then, and suddenly he was suspended for a different reason. I see manipulation and distortion, they're very big claims to be making, where Enoch was discriminated against all the way. His family are only standing up for something that we as parents should be protecting our children against. But it's just to go back to what Niamh had said. Are they being protected against it if it's being, you know, shouted in a speaker outside the school? Just to continue, and anyway, politicians will only meet with people they choose. They won't meet or talk with somebody they don't like. And there was another comment there, I've just mislaid it, but it essentially had said if the government would give the Birks a meeting, maybe this could all be prevented. I want to get to some requests. We have one here for Emma O'Donnell and Thomas Devaney, who are getting married today in Annagry. That's from Auntie Susan and all the family in Milford, and also from Nana Frances in Rathmullen. Emma and Thomas, have a lovely day. The forecast says it's meant to get a wee bit sunnier in the afternoon, so hopefully the grey skies will lift away for your photos. And there's another one in for Emma and Thomas, and that's from Auntie Bernie, Uncle Mickey and the family. Hello, can you do a wedding request for Michelle Harkin and Gareth Porter, who are getting married tomorrow? Love from Jamie and Niamh McLaughlin. And finally, please wish our friend James McLaughlin, homie, I think it says, and Karen Donna, a happy, very happy special birthday today. Enjoy your day, James, from your 2 Malin dolls. Wonder what that's about. We're going to go to the Greg Hughes podcast now. So coming up on this week's podcast, our guest is Mickey Jo Hart. Greg is looking back at the absolute madness of the post-Eurovision whirlwind and what it's like to really navigate primetime reality TV. And he shares the story behind an incredible unreleased charity single and so much more. So here is a wee sneak preview of what is to come.
Yeah, when you're young and what happens, you're going, Jesus, this is great and here I am. And, you know, everybody thinks I'm amazing and all that kind of stuff that goes on in your head. And then you very quickly realise that, wow, there are so many pitfalls in this industry and so many pitfalls. And it was a tough time. I had a huge big year too, and then, you know, the phone stops ringing. Yeah, and that's really hard. And no one ever asks you, really. I think my mum asked me once, are you okay, kind of thing. You know, and I think she I was able to kind of...
I think it's what sports people get after retirement. It's that, is it relevance or is it... I've lost the momentum here, or...
Yeah, the momentum is a big thing as well. And then, you know, we made I was with Sony, and I always say...
What did they want from you?
Well, I mean, We left Sony to set up my own label, you know, or I left Sony and we set up my own label, and I never regret that, you know. And
but
I
did
still
they say we want an album? We want
I'm sorry, with hindsight, it's a great thing, as you know. But we did the first album. It was number one, and we had a number one single, and everything was great, biggest selling single in the country. And then we went in to have a meeting with them afterwards, and they wanted to do a second album. Was like, I had a 5-album deal with them. They wanted to do the second album, but they didn't want to pay me my advance. And I was like, what am I going to live off? You know, I know there's gigs and stuff. They sort of said, well, if they were like that. And I was thinking, well, here's I had a number one album. I've had a number one single with the biggest selling single, and still, they're telling me that we've lost. Yeah. I'm not going to be able to improve on that. So I was kind of like, but they did want to do a second album, and I'll be honest with you, Greg, I'm probably sorry I didn't do the second album with them, because the reality was, when we set up my own label and we Swerve and all that, and we put a lot of time in it and a lot of money. I invested all of kind of the gigging money, and I just was putting everything back in. I wasn't taking anything out. I probably should have went off and built, you know, my big mansion I could have probably at the time, but I was so focused on putting everything back in.
But you were true to you, though.
Yeah, I was. And myself and my manager, it wasn't that we were just throwing money around and we were trying to, we were very conscious about it, and we were making decisions, and we were getting people to help with us. But, you know, it just became that. I always remember getting into HMV in Grafton Street, and we'd just released the album, the second album and the single and that. And previous to that, when it was with Sony, you'd open the doors would open up in HMV, and the first album you would see of that week would be my album with whoever else's was Beyonce's and all. You'd be up there, and that was the power of having somebody like Sony. When I had my own label, the album was down the back of the shop.
That machine wasn't there. That machine wasn't there. Which you paid for, I think. Well, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think when you sign a big deal with a record company, a lot of that comes out of your deal.
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
You get an advance, and it's great. And it wasn't a huge advance, but it was enough. You know, it was kind of like, you know, it was a little bit of a, you know, buffer. You weren't able to go off and, you know, and as a man says, sail into the sunset. But it was a bit of a buffer at the time, and it was great, you know, because I was young and I'd always had to struggle, you know, to get money. So I paid the bills for a few months, I suppose, those advances. But it was never that huge. And then I suppose the pressure of just being with the label, and I think all those things kind of, you have to weigh it up.
Coalesced into it.
Yeah. You have to kind of try and weigh it up and figure out whether. But, you know, I probably would have liked to have done a second album with them and then seen where it would have went, because they can also open up doors. And as a songwriter and a performer, you know, you can get they can get you with people,
collabs,
get you on support things, and they've just
regret.
It was a bit hasty.
you wish you had done the second album, but you don't regret your decision.
I don't regret it now, and so far.
I do regret it.
You know, there's no point in me saying I don't regret it, because I do. I often wonder what would have because the songs were better, the second album was better, it was a more mature album. I think it would have, you know, I remember playing it to a few people, or getting it into the hands of a few people, and, you know, them coming back to good, serious people and saying, man, this is, you know, this is fantastic, you know, I want to work with you, you know, I just want to figure out with the labels if we're okay. And then people are kind of like in that business. You, if they know you're with Sony or something, say, okay, yeah, there's a possibility.
But even
of
now,
us
saying it, it's like, oh, you're with Sony.
Yeah, you know. So and so that changes a bit. So yeah, I was, you know, yeah. I look back and I don't, you know, I don't lose any sleep over it anymore. But it's like one of those things. You often wonder, that was a bit hasty, you know. And we thought we were doing the right thing based on the analysis of the first album and all that. And we kind of had this option of 2 weeks to get out of the contract, and we sort of bit the bullet and said, okay, let's set up our own label.
And it could have gone a good way. It could have been the worst decision you ever made either.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that's the thing about it.
Absolutely.
And that's why I can trouble, because you simply don't
you
know.
You don't know. And the label, you know, we still have Swerve and it's still active. And so maybe that's, you know, a good thing. But funny enough, I reconnected with Sony on a different thing in the last year. So
been in the office. All together.
It's weird. I've been in the offices again. There's one guy that still works there that remembers. He says, oh, I used to be here when you were in there. All the rest of the staff are completely changed.
Celebrities Go Wild, any good? Good thing to be involved
in? I was, yeah. You know what? I'll tell you why it was good. you get to know a few people. One of the things that I take from it is that Katie French, who died not long after that, she was a model, and she Katie was a great girl. And
that was a terrible tragedy.
Oh, terrible, absolutely, and it broke our hearts. And but she was an incredible person. She was great fun, and I struck up a great friendship with her. And she used to organise these shows, you know. She was very proactive. She would just, you know, lift the phone. Oh, we'll do a show on such and such. And she would put a four or five of us together. I remember us being in Kerry somewhere, in Dingle or somewhere. And Dave Fanning and Brendan O'Connor and myself. And you know, she'd say, get you up and sing. And I'll come up and sing. And, you know, and she would sell these packages. And she was a real doer. And she would sell these packages. And she'd ring you up and say, oh, we're in Mullingar this week. Come on. And she would kind of have these things going on. And she'd just include you in them.
What a buzz.
Oh, brilliant. And it was just, you know, she's great. And she just died so quickly, and you know, it was so tragic what happened, and it was in the middle of all that. And but coming off the back of Celebrities Go Wild, not a lot of people know this. We went in, got everybody together. Victoria Mary Clark was part of it, who's Shane McGowan's girlfriend, and Victoria, I always got on really well with Victoria. She was a bit wacky, it was good fun, you know, and great crack. And she didn't want to conform at all to what they were telling her, so she left it then after a couple of days or so. So, but we stayed in touch. But afterwards, she sort of said, maybe we should do a charity single for them. You know, it was all for Telethon at the time, if you remember that. That was like a charity, like a big, the Red Nose Day, or whatever you call that, similar thing. And, so maybe we can do a charity single. And I was going, alarm bells ringing, you know, charity singles, you know, what they're about. And then I said, I'm not sure, charity singles can be a bit of hit and miss. She said, well, so Shane said he would get involved and would do one of his songs. And then that changed everything. I said, different, you know. So we did, and I ended up producing it with a pal and Shane as well. And we were in Selbridge and Marion Guinness's house, you know, we're part of the Guinness dynasty. It was Keela's studio. They had a studio set up there, and Mary was able to organise, Victoria was able to organise all of that. And then I just got the band together, as it were. I called in a few favours, and we did this single, one of Shane's songs, and everybody sang, including Katie, and everybody, all the Celebrity Go Wild crowd, they all sang, and Michael Heady Ray and myself and Dahi O'Shea and all these people. We got everybody together, Tony Kenny, and we had this lovely kind of gathering of people. And and then a few days later, Victoria rang me up and she said, Shane wants to do a B-side. He's never done Danny Boy. And I said, okay. I said, geez, I don't know if I'm going to be able to call in all these favours, the band. You know, she said, she just wants you with the guitar and him.
Wow.
Can you come? And I was in Dublin doing a thing with RT every Tuesday at the time. And I said, okay, I'll pick him up, because they lived out there in Donnybrook, right close. So I picked him up and we went out to Selbridge, to the studio, and we were really late getting there, you know, by the time we'd got Shane picked up and all the stuff done, we had a bit of dinner. And we did Danny Boy, myself and him, and I had that recording. And it's just funny you should mention that, because about a month ago I came across them again, and I got in touch with Victoria and I sent her on the stuff. So I have them and she has them now, so I don't know what's going to become of them. But
so they were never released?
They were never released because Katie died about a week afterward, and we all kind of... There was a decision made. We sort of said some people wanted to release it. I didn't want to release it because I just thought it wasn't. This is not.
You couldn't make it feel right.
The song wasn't right either. It was quite. It's one of Shane's songs. There was a bit of talk about down on the ground and all these kind of things. Yeah. And it, you know, the narrative on it, the lyric on it, and all that. So and in other contexts, it would have worked perfectly well. But it never got released, and it hasn't ever been released yet.
That's Mickey Joe there with Greg. God, wouldn't you love to hear that version of Danny Boy? So you can get that on Spotify, Apple Music. It's also going to be on our website. So wherever you get your podcast, you can get that one. Now, it's 25 minutes past 10. I want to read this comment, and it says, pedestrians need to take responsibility for their own safety. Yes, so they should wear high-vis or at least an armband. But maybe more importantly, the earphones while walking and crossing the road need to end. Well, I'm joined here on line one by David Scanlon, a driving instructor with Aviva Driving School. And David, you've said that pedestrian behaviour has become an epidemic.
Morning, Donna Marie. Yes, I don't think it's too strong a statement to say that. You know, it's always been an issue, of course, but I've been working in this town now for about the last 12, 13 years. And just in the last few years in particular, I mean, to me, it has just reached chronic epidemic proportions.
In what way, David?
Well, you know, there's two words which I kind of, you know, we need to think about, and that is personal responsibility. I mean, I drive around this town every single day, and, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not, you know, I know there are an awful lot of things wrong as regards road safety. I know there's a lot of, you know, drivers on the road as well who are, you know, driving from far in an exemplary manner. But pedestrians in particular, the single biggest issue is the mobile phone. I mean, it is almost impossible at this stage to find a pedestrian walking across the road without talking on a phone. Sometimes I joke to my pupils and I say to them, do you realise there's a new law out there now, or there's a new rule out there? You must be talking on your mobile to cross the road. It is just...
Oh, David.
At this stage now, it really is, you know, and I'm sure every driving instructor, if anybody else is listening to this, would probably agree with me.
Well, I can tell you there's definitely one, David. My own father's driving instructor, and just whenever you said that, I just got flashbacks to whenever I was doing my lessons with him. So the phone is one thing. What do you make of the earphones or the headphones?
They are another major, you know, to be honest, Donna Marie, anything that distracts us while we're on the road, you know, I mean, it's impossible to walk around this town now. You will not find a person who doesn't have their head buried in a phone. Mm. They're either looking at something, they're listening to something, they're talking to someone. Sometimes I say, who is everyone talking to?
Each other?
Because it has... Sorry?
It must be each other.
Well, absolutely. But I mean, another thing, you know, we talk about our responsibility. I mean, I see mothers, fathers, yeah, walking across at pedestrian crossings with children, with a buggy, talking on a phone. Mm. It is beyond madness. They are trusting drivers. I mean, in this town every day, Donna Marie, I see umpteen drivers breaking red lights.
Yeah.
It's happening all the time. People are driving through red lights, yet pedestrians are trusting these people. I see pedestrians walking across at crossings. They never even look left or right to see if the vehicle has stopped. Mm. They just walk straight across. So they're putting their trust in that driver there. And I have seen so many near things with drivers shooting through red lights and people on crossings.
And, you know, looking left and right is one of the first things you're taught in school. David, how is it for your students?
Very, very challenging. I mean, Letterkenny is a challenging town anyhow to drive in. You know, Letterkenny has become a very difficult town in recent years. You know, the volumes of traffic here now, you know, the amount of people that are here, the town has changed immensely over the years. It's very challenging for young people. There's no two ways about it. It's a very difficult town to drive in. It's a difficult town to learn in. And, but as I say, personal responsibility, just that seems to be, someone else will deal with that. You know, the driver will see me, they'll stop, they'll break, they'll give way or whatever.
Yeah. It does seem
to be beyond.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, they will walk across totally oblivious to what is happening around them. I mean, in a nutshell, I'll just give you one example. Mm. Back a few months ago in the winter time. Now, this was an e-scooter. It wasn't a pedestrian as such.
Yes.
But it was a darkies road on the outskirts of town here, and I was driving home one evening. And I was driving along the road, and suddenly I thought I spotted something along the footpath. And now it was an e-scooter, no light, no reflector of any sort on it. Okay. There was a girl riding it. She had a black coat on, head to toe. Absolutely nothing to make her stand out. Mm. So I got my signal on, move out past her, and just as I was coming past her, I took a quick glance. What was she wearing? Set of headphones.
Oh, my goodness.
So she was completely oblivious. She had no idea what was coming behind her, whether that vehicle saw her. And that is it. But I mean, that's one example, Donna Marie.
Yeah,
that's just common every day.
And more common.
The one message I would like to say, the one message that I would like to say to people, for goodness sake, get your head out of phones.
Mm.
Put the phone down when you're crossing the road. You know, people need to get their head out of phones. They need to, again, cyclists, you know, people cycling with headphones on, cycling with the earbuds in. They haven't a clue what's behind them.
What's going on?
You know, the lack of responsibility is, it's really mind-boggling.
It is. It is. Thank you very much, David, because we're going from pedestrians and cyclists and e-scooters who are using their phones to drivers. Now, Sean here is online too, and I'm sure, Sean, that you have a similar message to get the heads out of the phones. Tell us about the experience that you had from your very own garden, Sean.
Yeah, good morning, Donna Marie. I was in the garden on Wednesday, and I'm just near the road on a very dangerous bend. And two lorries passed by within 5 minutes of each other from leading hauliers. And both drivers had their phone resting on the steering wheel, and they were looking down at the phone as they went around the bend, on a blind bend. And just a short time later, a bus passed by, and the driver had the phone up to his ear and talking away. And even yesterday now, again, I was just going around the corner of the house, and this car passed by, a woman driving, and she had her head thrown back and was drinking from a bottle of water with one hand on the wheel.
I see
every day.
I'd say many people will say, well, God, now we'll have a drink of water or something whenever we're driving. But in relation to the phones, Sean, is it the fact that it was professional drivers, or is it the fact that there was so many that really shook you?
Both, really. It's just so common. Everybody seems to be using the phone when they're driving, or a lot of people anyway. But I think in the case of professional drivers, you would think they would know better about how to behave on the road, and they wouldn't be so careless. As we all know, you know, tragedy can happen very, very quickly. And
yes.
They could, whatever about killing themselves or doing themselves injury, they could bring tragedy to some young family, or so somebody completely innocent coming the other way.
And it's quite a sad picture that we've painted this morning between David telling us about the e-scooter driver who was head to toe in black and with earphones on, and then, you know, if you had that combination of that individual and the individual of the you know, the big HGVs, like it's not worth thinking about.
Yeah. No, it's really frightening.
Sean, there'd be people who'd say, ah, no, you know, if something comes in, everybody, like, you know, what's that saying about throwing stones in glass houses, that everybody would have a glance at their phone at some point whenever they're driving. You know, what would be your opinion on that?
Maybe they do, but in my own case now, whenever I get into the car, I put the phone in my pocket. It doesn't come out if it rings. Even I wouldn't use the hands-free. If I need to answer a call or make a call, I'll stop at the side of the road and make the call. I don't think people really, well, in many cases, realise just how dangerous it is. I mean, from my own point of view, I can't handle a car unless I have the two hands on the wheel and just give it my complete concentration. And you can't do that if you're on the phone at
well.
The time.
That's the way that vehicles were designed to be driven, really, with the two hands. What's your thoughts, actually? It's interesting on, you know, the newer cars now, and in the front panel they have the touch screen and the, you know, all the there, it is a big screen that's on there. You know, what do you think about that?
I don't like that at all. I think it's hugely dangerous as well, because people's attention is drawn to that screen when they're driving along. You know, even if they're using sat nav or whatever, So I think, you know, it's another huge distraction.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting that they're like actually built into the cars. I find myself, you know, whenever you're in a car maybe that you're not familiar with or you've just gotten a new car, trying to figure out how to get like the air conditioning on whenever it's all, everything's in a screen, like it's not just the tactile buttons anymore, can be a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. I suppose it's from a marketing point of view for manufacturers, it's a good selling point for them, but from a driving point of view, I think it's a disaster.
Sean, you had a post up about the incident, and you had an Irish phrase at the end there. What was it?
If I can remember,
my pronunciation will be awful.
Neil Keel or Vilish, it doesn't. There's no sense to it. It's just a completely senseless thing going on.
It is. You'd wonder. I'll read you some of the comments here that we have to see if you've come across any of this. I've noticed more and more fathers and mothers pushing prams out for a walk while with their children, but they have one hand on the pram and the other hand to scroll on their phones. No one seems to live in the moment anymore.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, I suppose I'm getting boring at this stage, but I'm always going on about that as well. The way we use our phones, we don't sort of live life anymore. We just look at a screen.
Yeah.
And I've even seen drivers with young children in the back, and the drivers are on the phone at the same time. You know, if you put your children in that much danger, you know, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, Sean, thank you very much for joining us to raise the point this morning. Hopefully it will reach the right people. Just to get to some more of the comments here, I see more people using the phones as an excuse not to talk to anyone, so they can't be on the phones that much. And people have become so socially awkward that the phone's used as an excuse not to socialise. And you know what? You'll notice it. And see, next time you're going by a bus stop, just look at how many people are on the phone, and you know, it's just scrolling for the sake of it. I wholly agree with David's pedestrians that they don't take, or that with David that pedestrians don't take enough care when they're crossing and they dart across without looking. And my pet hate is people who cross the road when there's lights and are crossing 2 minutes up the road. Another thing is people who don't wait for the green man. Especially if you're an anxious driver. My bugbear and pet hate at the same time with people crossing the road is whenever people who have prams are going to look and they push the pram out onto the road and then look and then go. I highly doubt that they're doing it on purpose, but it's just something to be aware of. So thanks to Sean there and to David Scanlon, driving instructor with Aviva Driving School. If you have any opinions on that, be sure to get in touch with us. Well, I don't know if we could have had any of a better introduction than that there, because I'm joined in studio now by Robert Brown, the founder of the Northwest Truck Fest. Robert, good morning.
Good morning.
How are we all fixed for the weekend ahead?
We're getting there. We're nearly there.
Now, we're just chatting in the app. I suppose people, and I doubt there'll be many people who don't know what the Truck Fest is, but what can they expect from it?
They expect just to see trucks, a lot of them done with graphics and things like that, you know, and it's all work on trucks, and they come from all parts to it. You need to go, I can't really explain, you need to be there to see it.
Yes, that's a hard sell there. Come in and see it for yourself. So, we were just saying there, this is the 20th year. Whenever you started this 20 years ago, did you think that it would still be going?
I started this 20 years ago as a one-off because my daughter had MS and I wanted to do something for MS.
Yeah.
And me being a truck driver, I thought the only thing I can do is do a truck show. And we said we'd do one show, and with such an success, 20 years later, we're still doing it. And we done for, I don't know how many charities. I tried to think last night how many charities we done for, and I couldn't remember them all.
I'd say over the course of 20 years, there's been some money raised for it.
There's been a lot of money raised over the 20 years. A lot of money.
It's a real great day out, but it's something that you can bring the whole family to.
It's a day out for the family. That's what it's for, you know. And children love it. Especially children, they love walking around the trucks and seeing it, you know. And it's a good day out. And we have entertainment there for the children as well, you know. So it's something for everybody.
There is something for everyone there. The charities this year is Cancer Care West and the Irish Cancer Society, something that's going to have affected everyone, really.
Well, that's why I'm doing it the year. For that, and I've done it last year as well. It's because I had cancer myself.
Oh.
So that was why I've done it this 2 years in a row for the one charity. So, yeah, nearly every family has been affected with cancer somewhere. And that's why I wanted to do this, to see if it could help somewhere along the line, you know.
Yeah, and we hope that you're in good health and you're in better health now.
Good health again, thank God. I'm back thriving again and
excellent.
We're going to the show and thank God everything's going good.
It is. It's very hard to describe the feeling whenever that news lands on your door.
Oh, it's a shock. It's a shock, you know. But we got over it and I was very lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the importance of something's not right to say something. So you'll be enjoying. Were you able to be in there the full effect last year? Is this your first year back fully?
No, I was back. I had my operation in March and I had my truck show in August. And I was there.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Determination that will get you far. So
it was
a special year then with the 20th anniversary and now with, you know, you being able to, you know, celebrate your health. What sort of entertainment and stuff is there for the kids?
There's a fun fair there
for
the children, a small one, it's only rides. And there's music all day and their ice cream wagon and all that stuff, you know.
And it's good whenever there is a bank holiday weekend to be able to go. It's something different to do as well.
It's something different. And it's not something you're going to see every weekend.
No. And you know what? I've only moved to Letterkenny. It'll be just about a year ago now. But I remember whenever it was on the first time and we were in the middle of driving back and forth, bringing stuff up. I was like, what's that noise? And it was all the trucks, the horns of them. So it was. And it was just like we were driving by it and we're like, oh, I'd love to be going in there instead of going to have to unpack boxes. Like, it looks incredible.
Yeah, it is, you know, and another thing I want to say, like, we're going now 20 years. We're the longest going truck show in Southern Ireland.
Really?
Yeah, we're the longest one.
And whenever you have them 20 years behind you, you know, you'll have so many. How many trucks is in it?
It varies from years. It's usually around 300 or 250, around that. It depends, you know.
God, do you think, how'd you get all them in one place?
They're coming here that long now. We don't really contact anybody. They know to come, you know.
Mm.
And a good thing I like about, I noticed this few years, drivers that came here with sons along with them, they'd be sitting in the passenger seat. Mm. Now they're growing up, have their license, and they're driving themselves, you know.
Oh, my God.
Like, it's kind of a family thing. But they all know about it. It's going so long.
Aye.
You know, and the good thing about it, and I always say it, everybody says to Anne-Marie and myself, we run the truck show. Get it all together. But every year, I say the same thing. We could stand on that grounds a whole weekend. We would make no money. It's the lorry man that comes for that weekend. The show belongs to it, not us.
Yeah.
They make the show. And as well as that, the people that come to view them, it's all their show. You know, it's them makes it. Makes the money for the charities. Oh. All we can do is put it together.
Mm.
So, no, I want to thank everybody that comes every year and has been supporting us over the 20 years.
I'd say you have some stories from over the years. Is there any you can share on air?
No, there's some stories. No, I don't think we can share them on air, no.
Oh, brilliant, Robert. So just to remind everyone, where and when is it?
It's this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. The lorries will start coming tomorrow, I would say around 11 or so.
Mm.
A couple of them coming evening this evening. But we don't open the grounds until 4 o'clock for the public because it's too dangerous for the lorries coming in. So when we get them all in after 4 o'clock, we'll open the grounds. So it's open from 4 to about 9 tomorrow night.
Uh-huh.
And then Sunday, we'll open the grounds at 11 o'clock for the public to 5 in the evening.
And then there's a convoy then?
They leave there then, they have a convoy up through the town. Through the main street, and that's
fantastic.
That'll be it over for another year.
And if for anyone who does want to go, it's a great day out. And even I'd say, even if you don't think that you're really going to be into that type of thing, that you still will enjoy it.
They will enjoy it. It's something different.
Mm. Perfect.
Something different.
Well, Robert, thank you very much. Good luck with it. We'll hopefully hear loads from over the weekend, and you'll have social media. Everyone can have a wee look in.
Yeah.
There'll be photos.
Oh, there'll be lots of photos. Yeah.
There'll be evidence of the grave.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There will, indeed.
Perfect, Robert. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The lingering rain and drizzle should be hopefully cleared away now to give a largely dry day with plenty of sunshine and highest temperatures of 17 to 23 degrees. Don't know how much hope I'm holding out just looking out the window there, but hopefully we'll get a sunny bank holiday weekend. Very excited to be joined in studio by our very own Shannon Wilkins. Shannon, this is the first time that we have been allowed to be on air together.
Yeah, imagine.
Fantastic.
We can just let loose now. Have a good gossip.
No jobs come 11 o'clock. So what's been happening on the internet this week?
I think the thing that's kind of been breaking the internet a bit is Sean Fitz, the Galway GAA star who is going to be on Love Island. So the rumour mill started last week and there was very much a will he, won't he, but he's been officially confirmed now. But he's getting a lot of stick from GAA fans, like, would you really give up finals to go on Love Island?
I feel like Love Island, there's probably a bit more money involved. And then, you know, whereas with GAA, it's like, well, the age-old argument. Can you believe that these boys go out
don't
and
get paid.
They don't get paid for it?
And is he going to keep up the training when he's in there? What's the diet going to be like?
I'd say the training will be a big part of the camera or the what's the camera time. I'm wondering, will he be doing a Paul Mescal and wearing the teeny tiny O'Neill shorts?
GAA shorts. He'd mm-hmm. have to, wouldn't he, to try attract the girls?
Oh, absolutely. But, like, Irish people do quite well on Love Island. Like, they come out of it, do you think?
I think because, like, we're known for good banter. Like, we've yeah. never had a contestant on that hasn't been fun or had something to them. Like, Maura Higgins, that catapulted her entire career. So, Fitzy is actually a TikTok star as well. So, maybe this is another way for him to increase his platform. Do you know?
Yeah.
Maybe it's what he yeah. wants to do. But he's actually a primary school teacher, so he's Ooh. Able to go. Do you know, like, can you imagine we walk in and we're like, hey, Caroline, just need a few weeks off, work here.
Oh, I don't know. There was controversy as well before about a teacher being on there.
Yes,
I think
actually.
I think there probably will end up being more talk about the teacher element than the GAA element.
But he's primary school, so are they going to be watching Love Island? I think it's a bit different if it's secondary school, but I suppose they'll know he's on it and the internet exists.
Mommies and daddies will be watching it and they'll be like, yeah. oh, Mr. Fitz, how are you doing? What else have we got on the list?
So we were just chatting about this briefly off air. So you might have seen a lot of influencers recently with significant weight loss, but mm-hmm. they're also starting to get the same kind of body shape. And a few more fitness influencers have been commenting that there's no way that these people are dropping this amount of weight this quickly. It's definitely Ozempic or Mounjaro or one of those, and they're trying to urge them to be honest with the younger audiences.
That's it. I don't think the issue really lies within the fact like anyone's entitled to take the medication if they choose to do it because that is their bodies, but to make sure that that's, you know, it's known, you know. And I think people as well would be interested in knowing about it.
Yeah, just be honest, like, because you're looking at them then and you're like, oh my God, like, I should look like that. Mm. But even someone was telling me this is like the same as when someone was talking about tanning injections. You got those years ago. Yeah. And this girl was saying how she went online, ordered them, and her parents never found out. So that's the danger of it. Are children going to be trying to get counterfeit ones and hurting themselves?
You know, if you go down that, you know how the algorithm is, if you go down researching, is it the GLP-1, is that what they're called? Like the generic sort of, like, I think that's what's in it to make you lose weight. It's going to absolutely flood your social media. Like, that's all they're going to see.
I know.
It's a slippery slope.
Because it's so easy to just do it as well.
And it's so easy to buy something that you think will be, you know, it's so easy to buy something that you think is one thing and it might not be it at all.
Yeah, exactly.
I am very excited. I see Julie Andrews on here, and Julie Andrews is one of my favourite people.
So she's actually come out for the first time in about 7 years. Oh. She did a wee video for Parkinson's awareness, but she's just such an icon. Like, her voice is completely the same. Like, obviously she's aged a bit, but she's still so glamorous. And I think we all just love her, really, don't we?
Julie Andrews is such a lady. So she is. And she's like in a real gentle kind of way. And I feel like everybody will associate her with something different. For me, she'll always be The Princess Diary.
Aren't they making another one of that
yeah,
too?
They are. And I can't wait. Yeah. I can't wait. That was like my sister's favourite film growing up, and she, Kellyanne's older than me, so I was always like, that's so cool. I love The Princess Diaries too.
You were like, this is something to bond over?
Yeah, yeah. And she's like, go away, stop. Stop following me. Following around her and her friends. That's good. But it's nice to see. And sometimes it is. It's just, it's nice to see people that you loved whenever they were younger and that, see that they're, you know, doing all right. And as well, for Julie Andrews to be making a Parkinson's awareness video, and like, that's going to have a massive reach.
Yeah, exactly. And she's 90 years old as well. So, like, fair play to her.
Oh my goodness. I think we have time for a very, very quick last one. Irish sunburn competition.
Did you see this one? I nearly got caught out with this. So basically, Joe.ie, they do a load of skits, but try to make everyone as red as possible, Irish people having sunburn. So you'd go kind of the most harsh tan lines, the burn. They got a fake doctor, which it was obviously a skit, to judge it. But it actually ended up making a Spanish daytime TV show.
What?
They thought it was real and they were like, oh, look at these Irish people, and should they do exactly the same thing when they come over to Spain? You see it all the time.
It's so embarrassing.
Isn't it? So stereotype, but yeah.
That's okay. Well, I suppose to leave it on that there, wear your sun cream. It's been a lovely, lovely weather, and hopefully have a good bank holiday weekend. Shannon, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna Marie.
And thank you to everyone who's been listening, to Shannon and to Caroline for assisting with producing and researching the show. And we'll see you all on Tuesday morning.